that song comes to a crescendo. It talks about the coming King, the one that we are here to worship today. And so I hear those words, those names of God, the way that Christ rings out through Scripture. And my heart wells up in wonderment. And I'm not just saying that. I can't honestly listen to that song, or I can't listen to songs that proclaim the many and mighty names of Jesus without becoming very taken in by it. And, you know, we are in this Christmas season where in many ways I think we've lost a lot of the wonderment of what this all means. I think it becomes very haphazard. It becomes very rushed because we are so full of so many different things going on. And it's very easy for us to not stop and take a breath and remember. So we're going to be taking some time to remember. There's a great passage here in Micah that says, "Remember what I have done, says the Lord." And I think about the wonderment of Christmas, and I think back when this young lady who sits at the piano pretty much every week, many weeks anyways, Olivia, when she was 4 years old. A wonderful story that I think of when I think about the wonderment. You know, we as a family, Catherine and I, we're not real hard and fast one way or the other as far as we'll just call them mythologies so that I don't know who's here. I don't want to ruin it for anybody. But the Christmas mythologies, if you don't understand what I'm saying, right? Okay? And so we're not like, oh, you can't tell this and we can't do that. We didn't ever lie. We just said, you know, this is what's going on. But yet, Olivia was part of the public school at that time, and she was going to a pre-K, I believe, at that time. And there was all kinds of things about Santa Claus and things. And so she got a lot in her mind, and it somehow, even though I think she was having a hard time as a 4 or 5 year old trying to decide what mom and dad were saying, what's all this other stuff with Santa Claus, all this kind of stuff. So one day, that year, at Christmas Eve service, Catherine had gone out to purchase some last minute items, and I was sitting in my living room and I looked out through the kitchen door. Some of you are just there if you could picture this. Sitting on the couch looking through the kitchen, and there's Olivia with these little Dixie cups, and she's spitting water. And as, you know, and my father came out of me, I'm like, "Olivia, what are you doing? What are you doing? What can you possibly be doing?" She's taking water from something, I don't know what, and spitting into these little Dixie cups. She said, I just had to laugh because she says somehow in her mind she just got the idea she was putting out the 8 Dixie cups for the 8 reindeer. Okay, so there it is. And at that time we had this big counter, and she had Dixie cups and that she had spit water into all across these things, and she was setting up Santa's thing. I said, "Olivia, don't you know that if you set those there in the window, that the reindeer are going to come and they're going to make a mess of this place tonight?" And so I just kind of played along with it. I had no idea where she came up with the idea or anything like that. She says, "Well, it'll be okay. They won't do that. They'll take it outside," she says. She says, she was promising me that there would be no mess. And so, as the good father that I am, we went off to Christmas Eve service that night. And I went and I picked up some chocolate peanuts. And I brought them home. The kids all go to sleep. And we just made a mess. Catherine and I together made a mess of the kitchen. We put chocolate peanuts all over the floor. We took the water. We tossed it all over. My whole point of this is this. When you have a mind, and you know, the next morning, we were sleeping, if you guys know my house, we were basically right in the middle of the house at that time. And we were sleeping where the twins are now. And I heard Olivia wake up at the break of dawn, and I heard her little feet go. I mean, we had a Christmas tree that was packed full of stuff, right? Walks right by, right to the kitchen. All I hear is, "Oh." And she ran back to her room. And at that time, you could go through her room back into the back. And she went all the way around the house and went through the other kitchen door. Oh! Never saw a single present or anything like that. All she saw was this mess. I won't tell you how the rest of it goes. It was a lot of fun, and we played it out a couple of years in a row. I think she now does it to her little sisters every once in a while. But the wonderment, the wishful thinking, the that kind of picture that we have of what could be. And yet, we're talking about hope today. We're talking about this love of Christ, this presence of God, and this true creator that has given us and birthed in us this desire for him. And we see over these weeks how much he has a great desire for us. And I can say this, that my wonderment of God and his excellencies and all of the namesake that he has, my wonderment of him is not some wishful thinking, not some, oh, I hope, or it's not some wishful thinking. My hope is cemented in the true hope that is assured to us. That is a hope, right? The hope of Christ is something that is assured. It's not a wishful thinking. I hope I get this for Christmas, or I hope this is true, or I hope. It's not that kind of a hope. It's not a wishful hope. It's an assured hope. And so as we look at Micah today, let's remember that this is a God who sees all things from end to the beginning. And he says, my people, throughout all the ages, throughout all my scripture, I have been there. And I have given you hope in every step of the way. Let's look. We're moving straight to Micah chapter 6. I'm sorry, Micah chapter 5. You're going to see here that God is setting us. He's setting us a story. And it looks bad at the beginning, and it kind of just seeps right into this hope. And God is telling us today, he says, you feel like you're in the clutches of defeat. You think you're at the bottom of the valley. You think that you are run down and down and out. You think everything's against you. You think the pressures of Christmas or the pressures of health and the pressures of whatever are crushing in upon you. And I'm here to tell you, remember me, says God. I am your hope. I am your salvation. I've got this okay. I've got it worked out. Seems like the world is out of control and crazy and chaotic. But I have it in hand. Chapter 5, verse 2, verse 1 says, now daughter who is under attack, you slash yourself in grief. A siege is set against us. They're striking the judge of Israel on the cheek with a rod. Now we can look at that and we can see there are some words here that are very descriptive of what happens to Jesus Christ going to the cross. Certainly, he is our hope, right? But this is not a hopeful verse in the way that it's presented here, is it? You're under attack. The very leader that you had placed all your hopes upon, he is under attack. He is being pushed down. He is being struck upon the cheek. This Jesus who you are looking forward, this Messiah, it's not looking too good. But isn't it interesting that it starts out at the end or the somewhat end of the Jesus story, and the second verse goes right into the hope. Under your attack and in your grief, as your ideas of direction and the leadership that has been given to you, as that kind of all crumbles around you, it seems, and as the world, again, kind of just implodes upon itself, and we work from one political conundrum into another, as the ages go on, it will continue. It's nothing new under the sun. And God says, in the midst of your grief, in the midst of what seems like the end of your hope, verse 2 says, here is your hope. Bethlehem Ephrah, you are small among the clans of Judah. One will come from you to be ruler over Israel for me. His origin is from antiquity, from eternity. Out of the clutches of defeat, God says, I bring you revival. I bring you hope. And it's not a simple hope. It's not some simple little plan. No, it is something where I am going back from antiquity. I'm going beyond antiquity, actually. I'm going from eternity to bring this hope to you. This is not something that is short-sighted. I've said this before from here, but I understand that it wasn't as though Adam and Eve transgressed in the garden and all of a sudden God said, what am I going to do now? How am I going to ever get these guys back? How will I ever do this? No. The eternal God saw the end from the beginning. It makes no difference where he starts this story, quite honestly. He's getting struck in the cheek in verse 1, and he's bringing us this gentle hope of Bethlehem in verse 2. What an amazing God we have. That he sees you in the greatest of your crises. And out of the greatest crisis you could possibly have, he says, here's hope. You seem small. You seem insignificant. You seem like, how could God possibly even think about me? Because I'm not all that. And none of us are. And so we kind of go through this life sometime defacing ourselves and kind of looking down. It's like, you know, kind of drudgery, like the little Eeyore, you know. Woe is me. It's always raining on me. Where's my tail? You know, Eeyore, you know what I'm talking about? Eeyore, down in the dirt. But God says, listen, in the midst of your downtroddenness, in the midst of your crises, I bring you peace. And you seem small, you seem insignificant, but out of you springs up a divine and eternal appointment. If God could take small Bethlehem, which today, I'm not sure if you even realize, is not even part of the country of Israel. You realize that? You actually have to traverse into Palestine in order to get to the birthplace of Jesus. Most Jews cannot even go there. And so here we are, in this tiny little place, forgotten by all history, except for the heart and mind of God. This place is so remote that if you were to look at the common critics of the Bible and the common historians will say, they say this whole concept of Jesus being born in Bethlehem is just a total fallacy. It's such a farce because it could never have happened this way. Bethlehem is so insignificant. Nobody ever, even today they're saying this. I've heard literally in the past couple months, I've heard of a historian who has gone back and critiquing this and said the only reason they ever said that Jesus was born in Bethlehem is because of what Micah said. Well, you can choose to believe that if you wish. If you want to be cynical and you want to be critical about it in that regard. But I believe that the Word of God was put together in a way that was promoting the very impossible, holy and incredible and wondrous story of Christ. And he takes what is completely impossible, the completely insignificant, and he makes it significant because it was formed from eternity. This divine story that comes and he says, it is from antiquity. He is from antiquity. In fact, he is from eternity. From before time existed. In verse 3, we start to see a little bit more about this shepherd of ours, this hope of all the nations, Therefore, he will abandon them until the time when she who is in labor has given birth. Then the rest of his brothers will return to the people of Israel. And he will stand and shepherd them in the strength of Yahweh, in the majestic name of Yahweh, his God. And they will live securely, for then his greatness will extend to the ends of the earth. He will be their peace. When Assyria invades our land, when it marches against your fortresses, we will raise against it 7 shepherds, even 8 leaders of them. And here is our shepherd who is now the warrior, this little babe who is going to be born in Bethlehem. Yes, we know the end, that he will go and be struck on our account. His beard will be ripped off of his face on our account. He'll be nailed to a cross as such on our account. And there lies our secure hope. What most people, or many people in this world, mistake about our faith is that it is a wishful hope. And God's telling us hundreds of years before this story is going to unfold how exactly he is going to do it. And as I said last night, God could tell any part of his, or last week, God could tell any part of his story anytime he wishes. And so hundreds of years before Jesus is to walk this earth, he speaks it through his prophets, and so it was. But it wasn't as though God had put it in the prophets and said, well, I hope this works out. God, the sovereign king, he places it into order. And he says, my shepherd will come, and he will strike the enemy, and he will be in your presence. It is by this that we come in the Gospels to hear of Jesus, our present God, God with us, Emmanuel. You will name him Emmanuel. As you look at that, perhaps some of you are a little bit confused as that, because as you look through the story, and you'll hear it, I'm sure, on Tuesday night in different ways, it's Christmas Eve, perhaps on Christmas morning as well, you'll go through the story and you'll see that the angel says, and you will name him Emmanuel, God with us. And then you hear that the next verse, Mary names him Jesus. Well, was she going against what the word is? Of course not. What the word is that his name will be, his title will be God with us, Emmanuel. The word Emmanuel is God with us. It's a title that is placed upon the very person of the Messiah. And it's not simply the Messiah the way that the Jews were looking for necessarily. The Messiah, they didn't necessarily believe that he was going to be divine, that he was going to be God's son, but they knew he was going to be special. They thought he was pretty much going to be just a human form. Well, God takes this whole story. He says a human form isn't enough. Human form is necessary because the sacrifice has to be equal to the task. But it will be divine because only my divine righteous son can be the hope for the nations. And so we have this beautiful hope, this beautiful shepherd, this God with us, Jesus, here in Bethlehem as a babe, right? But we see him growing up pretty fast here in Micah. For he is not only God with us, he is God for us. He is for you, not against you. He is God's strength on our account. Look and hear the words of his care. Look in here to see the words that prove out his great glory. He's going to be the shepherd. What does the shepherd do? He cares. He tends. He protects. He raises up under shepherds to guard and protect, to come alongside. And the strength of Yahweh is seen in Jesus Christ. And Jesus Christ is all about the name of his God. He is all about his glory. And what we saw last week in the book of Joel, God is all about and always about his great glory. There is no greater glory that God has than the fact that he takes this mess of a story of my life and he embeds within me the great glory of his Son, Jesus Christ, to overcome all my mess and to bring all hope into my life where there is hopelessness. That is his great glory. The hope of glory is that he has done that for me. And the hope of Jesus Christ is that he has taken me and he has walked me into strength and might and victory. And he has my security in the grasp of his hands. So he will rescue us. Verse 6. Now he's speaking. He speaks to the people of Israel of the day. And he speaks to the people of Israel in Jesus' day. And he speaks to the people of God in our day all at one time, right? And that's the beauty of God's great prophecies. When you're looking at a mountain chain, you're looking at the Rockies, we'll say, and you're coming upon it, and you see the Rockies, McNutt's, you travel out that way, and all of a sudden you see like a haze of the mountains, right? April's heading that way right now. And just beyond that, you see another fold of it, and then just beyond that, another fold of it, and perhaps it goes on. That's the same way as prophecy looks to us. We see the forefront, and if we're up super close and we're examining that, we can look at it in that time frame, in the time frame that Micah is speaking to the people of Israel. The people of Judah have need hope. And Micah is presenting a great hope for the people of that present day. But as the fold of mountains behind that kind of comes into focus, you can see that he's also speaking, and God is speaking really, and it is his eternal word that continues to melt in upon our hearts from generation to generation. And so we get to Jesus' day, and they're looking back at the story, the words of the prophets. And when Matthew recites this prophecy from Micah, he is looking back and saying, this is what Micah was speaking of. It is hope for us today, 600 years later. And now we look at these words of Micah, and we look at this, and we hear about the shepherd, and we hear about, okay, so Assyria looks a little different to me today than Assyria did back then. But my Assyria is the pressures and the conflicts of this life that I find today. That's my Assyria. And the prophecy is just as hopeful for me today that the King of Kings has set aside a shepherd, his son, Jesus Christ, to oversee my life and to bring me hope in this present day as he did for the people back in Micah's day, as he did for the people in Jesus' day, as he does for us today, so be his glory. His glory, fold after fold after fold, however you want to look at it, this great prophecy speaks upon our lives. And he says there's hope for you because my security will surround you and you feel invaded, but I am there for you and my shepherd, my Jesus, my Messiah will come and he'll show you a place of rest. And so finally he says there's a peace, the peace of Yahweh, the great God who rescues you and restores you. Then the remnant of Jacob will be among many peoples, like dew of the Lord, like showers on the grass, which do not wait for anyone or linger for mankind. And verse 9 says, your hand will be lifted up against the adversaries, and all your enemies will be destroyed. There is security, there is peace, there is a lasting hope. And I want to go right into this next part, because our hope is not in anything that we ourselves do. It is very important for us to understand that the hope of this Messiah, the hope of this Jesus, the remembrance that we will have is not in what we have done. We do not, and I suggest to you not to do it this way, do not take the Lord's Supper and think about all the good things that you have done in order to make yourself worthy of this. That's very dangerous. We do not take the Lord's Supper in remembrance of what we have done. We do not take the Lord's Supper in remembrance of how good we have been in order to be worthy of this. It's just the opposite, right? And this is where we're talking about in Micah. This is beautiful. Look at this, the I will statements of God here. This is, in that day, this is verse 10, this is the Lord's declaration. Look at how many I wills he will put here. I will remove your horses from you and wreck the chariots. I will remove the cities of your land and tear down all your fortresses. I will remove sorceries from your hand, and I will not have any more fortune tellers. I will remove your carved images and sacred pillars from you so that you will not bow down again to the work of your hands. I will pull down the Asherah poles from among you and demolish your cities. I will take vengeance and anger and wrath against the nations that have not obeyed me. I will. I will. And it's a reckoning. Sounds like we're going back into all these harsh words, but God is saying this. No, I have done this. I will do this for you. And what is he doing? He's not crushing people. He's bringing them back to himself. He's enlivening them so that they can be purified, so that the presence of God can be back amongst them. I say that because I know what chapter 6 says. Okay? But God's heart is always for you. He doesn't set you up to take a big fall for nothing. He breaks us that he may bind us up. So return to the Lord, he says. I will bring a lasting peace to you when he takes out your chariots. He takes down your fortresses. This is all war talk. There's a couple items here. Number one, I'm going to bring you to the point where you're going to understand that you need me desperately as your security and as your deliverer. And number two, I'm going to make it so you don't need those chariots and those fortresses any longer. For I am your Prince of Peace, and I will bring the peace upon your life. If you allow me in, if you allow me to take control of you once again. And so we have that lasting peace that is that war talk, and he's like, I want to put you at peace. But then he has these other things. He starts talking about sorceries and fortune tellers and carved images and sacred pillars and Asherah poles. And when he says demolish the cities, he's very specifically talking about the cities that were set up in the high places unto the gods, the demon gods, the Baal worships, and all that kind of stuff. I will demolish those things. I will demolish those places. You see, when we allow the presence of God to come into our lives, he not only gives us peace from the crushing violence that is against us and the pressures of this life, he says, I also want to do a holy act within you. I want to make you holy. I will do that. There's not a single time in all these verses that he says, well, if you will only do this, then I will hear you. No, he says, I will do this and you will hear me. I will bring peace. It might not be the way you thought I was going to do it, but I will bring holiness into your life. This is the refining fire that we talked a little bit about last week. That refining, the renewing comes through a refinement. All right? It removes out the dross and leaves a living and holy sacrifice unto himself. So that we may remember in holiness. So when we have this Lord's Supper time after time and month after month, so many times we talk about how important it is for us to be right before the Lord our God. This is not to be taken just haphazardly, right? This in itself is a moment of commitment. This is me saying, I have committed myself unto the God of holiness, and I have committed myself to be therefore holy as He is holy. That's the remembrance, because I can only be that if He's doing that in me. But God says here, I will do that. I will remove this stuff from you. I will remove the dross and bring out a refined gold. I will bring it out because that is the one I will deal with and I will have presence with. And I will bring renewal and revival to. So as we look into chapter 6, I want us to be ready in our heart for true worship. This is an example of true worship before our God and King. To remember Him and all that He has done for us, that we may stand in His presence and be renewed. Rise, plead your case before the mountains, and let the hills hear your voice. Listen to the Lord's lawsuit. And He says, there's something I don't understand about you. He said, what have I done against you? My people, verse 3, my people, what have I done to you? Or how have I wearied you? So the question is, more to the point, why is your heart growing distant from me? What have I done to you? And then He says, listen, I want to show you the hopeful answer to that question. What have I done for you? Testify against me? What is He going to testify? Indeed, I brought you up from the land of Egypt and redeemed you from the place of slavery. He brought freedom into my life. That's what He has done. He hasn't captivated me and enslaved me in such a way that is out of obligation. He has brought freedom to my life. What have I done for you? Well, I've brought you freedom. What have I done for you, He says. I sent Moses, Aaron, and Miriam ahead of you. He's given me direction. He's given me leadership. He's given me an understanding, a perspective. What has He done for me? He's brought me freedom and direction. What else? My people, remember what Balak, king of Moab, proposed? What Balaam, son of Beor, answered him? And what happened from the acacia grove to Gilgal so that you may acknowledge the Lord's righteous acts? It's going to take a little bit for you to go back and to understand a little bit of the Old Testament workings here. This is the remembrance He's talking about, but remember what He has done in our lives. When He's talking about Balak, Balak commanded Balaam the prophet to curse the people of God. This is where the talking donkey comes in. Remember this book of Numbers? What was God's role in that? Well, there was a man who was going out to curse the people of God, and God stood in his way and changed the course of history. Instead of a curse that went upon the people, it turned into a blessing and a praise and a glory to God. What have I done for you? I've brought you freedom. What have I done for you? I've brought you direction in your life. I've brought you protection, and I've stood by your side. What have I done for you? What happened at Acacia Grove? Well, you know this by a different set of stories. Acacia Grove is what happened. That's the story of Rahab. Well, what did God have to do with Rahab? Rahab is that lady who stood and waited for the and actually helped the two spies, right? This is right there at the Jordan, where they're coming into the Promised Land, and Joshua sends them into to spy the area. And at Acacia Grove is where Rahab takes the spies in and protects them. Some of our conversation last night was actually about Rahab and how she actually lies on to offend for them. To get them to get the soldiers off their scent, if you will, right? Acacia Grove represents the life that was given to them. Those men were dead. They were dead in their tracks. And God preserved their life through the most unlikely of people. This prostitute named Rahab. That's what happens at Acacia Grove. What happens at Gilgal and all the way through this story of the coming into the Promised Land, it's salvation, salvation, rescue, salvation, hope, salvation, It is everything that God is to us. He says, remember, when we're remembering today, remember the freedom that he has poured into your life, people of God. Remember the hope that he has given to you by giving you direction and purpose in your life. Remember the life that he has given to you. Some of you, very practically, you've been restored to life. And some of you, he has saved you, and those of us who have received Christ, he has saved us from our eternal sin. And he has brought us hope in this. Remember me. And out of this remembrance, out of this remembrance comes my revival. This remembrance leads to a revival of worship. Because suddenly, the whole context begins to shift. What should I bring before the Lord when I come to bow down before God on high? What a beautiful question that is to ask. In the midst of all of our conflict, in the midst of all the craziness of this life, in the midst of this Christmas season, can we stop and just ask that question? Lord, what would you have me to bring to you in worship of you today? What would it be? He goes on with all kinds of ideas. Should I come before him with burnt offerings or the year-old calves? Would the Lord be pleased with thousands of rams or with 10,000 streams of oil? Should I give my firstborn for my transgression, the child of my body for my own sin? What are these questions? The answer, these are going to be answered here in a second, but it's showing this heart of anticipation, of desiring, how can I grow closer to you, Lord? How can I return to you? How can my heart grow akin with you once more? Will all these things bring me favor? Now, the prophet already knows the answer, right? He's already writing this out. So he knows, as he's writing this, he knows the answer. Should I do this? Will this bring more favor to my life? And the answer is beautiful, is it not? Mankind, Amherst Baptist Church, he has told you what is good. What is it that the Lord requires of you? To be a living and holy sacrifice, to act justly, to love faithfulness, to walk humbly with your God. My only hope in this life is set upon this man of hope. It's nothing that I will actually do. None of these are really things. They're generalized ideas of how to live in the holiness of God, to act justly, to love faithfulness, to walk humbly with your God. Doesn't say follow the Ten Commandments. What is required of you? Follow the Ten Commandments. I'm sure those are enmeshed in here. And I'm pretty sure the Ten Commandments have a lot to do with acting justly. Pretty sure the Ten Commandments have something to do with walking humbly if you do it right. To love mercy, to love tender, loving kindness. It's Hesed God, to be a person of Hesed love. This is what's required of us. As we come now to the time of remembrance, this is spelled out for us what holy, revived worship looks like. So we're going to ask that you take a couple steps today. We're going to do Lord's Supper today.